to The Debrief, everybody. A lot to talk about tonight, so let's get started. Attorneys for real estate mogul accused of killing a woman who had information about the killing of his own wife today trashed the so-called documentary film which led to murder charges. Robert Durst is the defendant accused of killing Susan Berman because the state says Berman had information which could have helped convict Durst for allegedly killing his wife. The key evidence, an alleged confession, came from the HBO film The Jinx, but the defense argues it was edited out of context. The film's creators claim they discovered the incriminating statements in a rambling series of thoughts when Durst went off to the bathroom with his microphone on during a filmed interview. The film's production company is hit the ground running.
Ground running, none of us would even be here. It was without controversy that their efforts to get Bob Durst charged are the reason we are here. The people had absolutely no intention of filing this case before Hit the Ground Running approached them after interviewing Mr. Durst several times, after the information they had gathered, and after they presented their PowerPoint presentation to the prosecutors.
The filmmakers of The Jinx do not want to turn information over to the defense. That's the subject of today's hearing. The defense suggested, as a starting point, that the filmmakers should create a privilege log. That's basically a list of what the filmmakers don't want to disclose and why. The defense attorney arguing the case said his own 12-year-old son could see through the privilege issues made by the filmmakers.
He posed a question that I think encapsulates what we're asking about better than anybody. He said, "Dad, how can you tell if the information is relevant if they won't tell you what they have?" Simple enough for a 12-year-old to get it. These are very, very capable First Amendment lawyers, and they have done a yeoman's job of preventing the disclosure of information that Hit the Ground Running does not want to share. Now, that being said, they know their opposition to a privilege log has no legal precedence, neither does our position asking the court to. It lies within this court's very sound discretion in looking at this and saying, look, fundamental fairness here. How can we go about this and make sure that we don't compromise Mr. Durst's right to a fair trial?
Next, the defense complained that while the state has been upfront about the volume of material the filmmakers have, the film's producer, Andrew Jarecki, has not been.
Through Mr. Lewin, who I trust always represents things accurately to me, we were told there were about 50 recorded interviews. Those recorded interviews were imaged by the FBI, turned over to the people. The people turned the same over to us. We later learned that there were actually 54 recorded interviews. We were told we had them all. But as this story evolves, I learned from Mr. Jarecki himself that there are at least three more interviews out there, recorded interviews. And it's a very important distinction here. I keep saying recorded interviews for a reason. But Mr. Jarecki wants us to believe these three recorded interviews that we don't have are of no moment. In fact, his own words, Your Honor, quoting Mr. Jarecki, "We have produced the overwhelming majority of the recorded interviews conducted for purposes of The Jinx." I get very nervous when I read that, Your Honor. There are a lot of qualifiers in there. Recorded interviews for purposes of The Jinx. There are far too many qualifiers in that little sentence to trust it. Mr. Jarecki goes on to explain, "The remaining recorded interviews are comparatively peripheral." I had to ask my son what comparatively peripheral meant because it was a bit confounding. But these quotes really do reflect the problem, Your Honor. The wordsmithing alone makes a lawyer in charge of ensuring Mr. Durst gets the fairest trial he can get quite nervous.
Something tells me this 12-year-old son is headed for law school. Anyway, in case you haven't seen The Jinx, here's a clip of what the defense is very upset about.
There it is. Your court.
You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. Mm-hmm. house. Oh, I want this.
Here's how Durst's defense team took straight aim at the filmmaker's journalistic practices.
During that project, they decided they needed to get Mr. Durst charged with murder. Therefore, given that motive, their credibility here has to be put in the proper light. They continue to represent themselves as journalists. Merriam-Webster is defined as a journalist as a person who collects, writes, distributes news or other current events to the public. What do journalists not do? Journalists do not interview folks, edit their material, piece it together to produce their motive, tease the suspenseful conclusion of their work for their dramatic series. Journalists just report the facts. They do not manipulate the facts and try to pass them off as the truth. And then embark on a national-wide media blitz of self-flagellation. Their victory lap at the conclusion of the jinx and Mr. Durst's arrest was halted only because of a very wise suggestion of one law enforcement member who called Mr. Drecke and suggested, "Hey, you might want to shut up. You're now the primary witness in a murder case when the man you got charged with murder faces the death penalty."
Attorneys Linda Kenny Budden and Julie Rendleman are with us tonight. This hearing is going on as we speak, so the filmmaker's attorneys are up there basically saying, we should be able to keep some of this, Julie, because it's privileged and there's a shield law in California that says we don't have to turn it over. Does that argument hold any weight?
Well, it does. I mean, there are, you know, the attorney for the producers is right when they talk about, you know, the standards that are required in order for to allow for this information to come out. The problem I have is that they're taking one little piece of a statement he made and using that on their direct case to prove him guilty. And so when that comes into play, the concern I have is, are there more statements he made within those interviews? Because that is not complete if the jury, or at least the defense and the prosecution, are not able to hear every single bit to put it in context.
So you're arguing rule of completeness. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this is one thing he said. We have to let all of it in so that you can judge the context of it.
Well, at least we want to hear the rest of it. It's not the bathroom conversation is not, the bathroom statements is not enough. There's obviously context to it, so we want to hear every aspect of that interview.
Linda, you want to hear the context.
I want to hear the context, but the shield laws are hard to get around. New Jersey's had one since, what, 1968, and I've been involved in some cases with that. You can't get around it. And if California enforces a shield law, the defense will get nothing. Not even a privilege log, which basically says, hey, lawyers in conversations with clients can give over a judge a privilege log, but you journalists, allegedly, according to the defense, you don't have to do anything, is what the defense, what the prosecution says.
Yeah, these privilege logs come out in civil litigation all the time, and you know what they look like.
Right.
There's a list, you know, email. Well, it's from attorney to client, and we're not turning it over because it's attorney-client privilege. It's advice. It's work product. It's
right.
Something that there is a legal privilege which exists to protect. Shield law, this is relatively uncharted water. I tend to like shield laws as a journalist because I don't like it when I get a story and then the police want to go look at all my notes, all my work, this, that, and the other thing about it. They can clearly have what goes out over the air. And usually you're shaking your head at me,
Julie. I agree with you,
but I
understand different. What you're saying. But the problem I have is then why should the prosecutor be allowed to use it? If you're
use
only getting a piece
because
or something.
Because they can right. use what goes out, in other words, over public dissemination.
But it wasn't even accurate.
But they're choosing it as opposed to giving due process to the defense to see what it is that they withheld.
So you're saying it's not accurate.
We know it wasn't accurate. We know that from at least from what we had read initially is that the statements were made out of context and out of order. And so we know for sure that what they put on air was not exactly what he had said.
So here's my quibble. Is out of context and out of order necessarily inaccurate?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't think it necessarily is.
Necessarily,
I mean, sometimes I have to go.
Automatically, it could be. Doesn't mean
mean it necessarily is.
But so that we just stop there. We say, okay, you could be guilty, you could be not guilty. We're just going to like pick it out of a hat.
Okay, well then there's the defense, and then the defense can get up there and tell the jury that look, this was all taken out of context,
and
it's backwards, and you can't trust it.
But you have to have a basis to be able to say that. So if they're going to put in that piece, you want to hear what came before it. By the way, I don't really care if there were statements made by other witnesses. I'm not so sure that that's relevant to this. But if there are interviews of this specific defendant, then how can a defense defend him if they don't hear the complete context?
I think we have another old-fashioned collision of constitutional rights. I'm going to be watching the rest of this hearing to see how the judge rules. One of the suspects involved in the disappearance of a Georgia beauty queen is facing new charges against a new victim. A grand jury indicted Bo Dukes on 11 new charges relating to a 2017 New Year's Eve incident. Dukes is accused of rape, aggravated sodomy, and kidnapping. Dukes was sentenced to 25 years in prison earlier this year in connection to the missing person case of Tara Grinstead. Grinstead went missing back in 2005. Dukes is accused of helping his friend Ryan Duke burn the body of Tara Grinstead and then concealing it for more than a decade. Jury selection is off to a slow start in the Colorado trial of a man accused of killing his fiancée last year. Prosecutors say Patrick Frazee beat Kelsey Barrett to death with a baseball bat. Crystal Kenny is the state's key witness. She says she was having an affair with Frazee when he asked her to poison and beat Barrett. Kenny claims she either refused or blacked out each time she tried to carry out the requested deed until Frazee finally killed Barrett himself and called Kenny to clean up the mess. Prosecutors then say Frazee burned Barrett's body, but her remains have never been found. Authorities did, however, find traces of gasoline where they think the body was burned. Frazee is charged with first-degree murder, solicitation of murder, and tampering with a body. Frazee's defense team failed to file paperwork that would have allowed them to name Kenny as the killer. Law and Crime cannot broadcast this trial because the judge says the courtroom in Cripple Creek, Colorado, cannot accommodate broadcast technology. Live tweeting of the case is also forbidden out of a fear jurors could read the tweets. So, opening statements are expected on Friday, and we will update you on the case the best we are able given the restrictions. Another case, starting with jury selection today, is the Tennessee prosecution of Key Anthony Garrett. He's accused of killing 51-year-old Cynthia Green, his next-door neighbor, by beating her with an iron and then stabbing her. Authorities say Garrett's DNA is on the iron and on broken dishes found near the victim's body. Originally, he told police he had never been inside the victim's house, but later admitted he'd been there once. We will be bringing you this trial as soon as the jury is seated. The Connecticut girlfriend charged in connection with a missing woman's disappearance has reportedly moved out of her co-defendant's house. Michelle Traconis, seen here, is charged with tampering with evidence and hindering prosecution in the disappearance of Jennifer Dulos. Traconis lived with the missing woman's estranged husband, Fotis Dulos, but has now moved her belongings out of his mansion. That's according to the Hartford Courant. New court documents, meanwhile, are due today in an appeal filed by Fotis Dulos, the husband, regarding a gag order in his case. The state sought the gag order to prevent Fotis Dulos from arguing that his estranged wife, Jennifer Dulos, disappeared in order to spite him. Fotis Dulos has long said that Jennifer may have even faked her own death. He even told a website in Greece that his marriage fell apart because Jennifer became mentally ill and was living like a hermit. Attorneys for Fotis Dulos say the defendant has a First Amendment right to defend himself in public against claims made by the state that he was involved with his estranged wife's disappearance. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a day of protests and change in police policy in the case of a shooting death of a Fort Worth woman. Plus, jury selection in the retrial of the former NFL player whose original trial resulted in a partial acquittal, a partial conviction, and a hung jury on many counts. Those cases are after the break. Changes are coming to Fort Worth, Texas police procedures in the wake of the deadly shooting of a woman in her own bedroom. The move comes as a so-called National Day of Outrage is planned Monday night, tonight, in memory of Tatiana Jefferson. Rookie cops in Fort Worth will no longer be assigned to patrol together. The officer who shot and killed Jefferson through her bedroom window was on patrol with another rookie officer that night. Protests are planned tonight in New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, and other cities. Also in Texas, another case of an off-duty cop shooting someone they mistook for an intruder. A Dallas police officer called 911 Saturday evening saying he shot a man inside his home. The intruder turned out to be the man's son, who's expected to survive. Officials have not yet released the name of the officer or the son. Jury selection beginning today in the retrial of a former NFL player on 9 sex crimes charges. A jury this past summer convicted Kellen Winslow II of forcible rape, indecent exposure, and lewd conduct as to 3 separate accusers. The original jury, however, acquitted Winslow of 1 charge and was hung as to the 9 remaining counts. There were 5 accusers in all. Those accusers are known publicly as Jane Doe's 1 through 5. Jane Doe number 4 was 17 years old when she says the defendant and his friend named Matt attacked her after she drank at a party. The original jury was completely deadlocked as to both of the charges related to this testimony.
I came, opened my eyes, and my face was being pushed into Matt's groin area.
Where were you when you woke up to that, or when you came to?
Is it a bedroom? On a bed.
Remember if that was upstairs or downstairs?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Do you know how you got from the couch to the bedroom being on a bed?
No.
What was Kellen doing at the time that he was pressing your head towards Matt's groin area?
He was penetrating me from behind.
Was he having sex with you?
Yes.
Was he having sex with you at the time that you regained consciousness?
Yes.
The prosecution addressed the credibility of Jane Doe number 4 in closing arguments.
Prior statements to Nicole Edwards, to Brandon Guillermo, and to her husband Troy M., the photograph. So all the testimony from the other witnesses and her prior statements and the text messages to Nicole Edwards is separate and apart from her testimony.
Was she lying to you as she sat there feeling the pain and trauma that she experienced as a 17-year-old girl? Was she lying to you when she sat there and had to recount every possibly minute detail that she was asked about from now 16 years ago in a difficult, traumatic, devastating event in her life, and she had the bravery and the courage to come forward, not for any self-interest, not because she was going to get something out of this, most certainly not. She had to go through hell being here. She wanted the truth to come out because this impacted her so deeply that she wanted her own daughters to know that they can stand up to a name, a man with status, a man who was strong and rich and successful, and had repeatedly taken things that weren't his.
Jane Doe number 4's friend and husband both testified that the victim told them about the alleged rape. The defense says their testimony taken together shows a consensual act, not a sex crime.
I don't even know how to start with Jane Doe 4. Jane Doe 4, something happened to her in high school. Clearly, she's upset with Mr. Winslow and has harbored a long-term resentment for Mr. Winslow. Regardless of what experience she had, she waited 15 years to disclose this to the authorities. He was a star. He was all pro. He was a professional football player. He had everything, and Jane Doe 4 knew that. But now, he's being accused of rape. And she reads from Sports Illustrated that they may use CTE as a defense. Jane Doe 4 would have none of that. None of that. He's not getting away with this thing. There's no way he is. So she contacts her friend. Her friend Nikki. Nikki, you remember? Do you remember? And then she didn't remember at first. She remembered Jane Doe 4 being annoyed and angry. Those were her words. That is more consistent with being in a room with a 19-year-old Kellen Winslow and his stupid friend Matt, who comes in and thinks it's funny, than it is with a gang rape. I mean, am I missing something here? I mean, applying the circumstantial evidence instruction, ladies and gentlemen, if one piece of circumstantial evidence subject to 2 reasonable interpretations, 1 points toward innocence and 1 point toward guilt, guess where this points? Toward innocence.
Documentarians from The Girl Who Cannot Speak visited Law and Crime earlier today and talked about victims from the Me Too movement. They've been watching the Winslow case very closely.
It's such a power issue. There's a deep sense of power over powerlessness, and that criminality is terrible. What happens is if you empathize the experiences of everybody, you reduce the risk of these things happening because you create more of a connection. I have found in this case, with the Winslow case as well, it's very hard. And even in our documentary, it's very hard to commit these crimes when you recognize that this person is a person, is an actual human being. If you separate yourself from that person as a human being, that begins to start where you can self-justify.
Linda Kenny Bodden and Julie Rendleman are back one last time here on The Debrief. Linda, you conducted that interview, and I got a sense listening to that clip that they would convict if they were on the jury here.
Yes, absolutely.
What about the due process guarantees the defendant enjoys?
Well, I try cases from both sides. I've been a prosecutor and all, and I think the cross-examination will guarantee any kind of due process that you have here. I would have convicted on Jane Doe number 4. I think we had this discussion when she was on the stand the first time. The time did not bother me. I thought her testimony was powerful and forceful, and I think listening to her, to me, she was very convincing, and I had no issues.
Julie, we had 9 counts where the jury was completely deadlocked, 3 that resulted in a conviction, 1 that resulted in an acquittal. And the acquittal was the older woman who said he did something in the weight room and then did something in the jacuzzi, but I couldn't see it.
Right.
The jury acquitted on that one. We were discussing this earlier today on the Law and Crime Network, and the consensus seemed to be, well, good for the jury, because if you can't see something, you can't levy an accusation.
Absolutely. I think, by the way, the jury basically, you know, had all these victims, alleged victims, and they parsed it out based on what they found to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And they found in this case that there was one person that had proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt and one that hadn't. In terms of the ones that are hung, this is for a new jury.
That's the list of charges that are coming back this week with this new trial. Linda, do we expect the one accuser whose case was completely adjudicated to come back and testify purely as a witness very quickly?
Yeah, yes. And I also think the prosecution needs to give Matt immunity and bring him back for victim number 4.
We'll see what happens. That's all the time we have on The Debrief. We'll see you back here tomorrow.